This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and however you listen, thanks for joining us today. We're going to start our show with Paul Breno. He's a filmmaker from Minot. We've talked to him before about the Magic City Clockers. That was a couple of years ago. It's a documentary that he produced about some fancy footwork. And Paul, thank you for joining us again today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's really an honor to be here again.
And the reason we're talking to you today is you have a brand new documentary, and this one is pretty topical. It's titled Coronavirus Versus the Magic City. Why did you want to make this documentary?
It was mid to late March, and we were celebrating my father's birthday. And as everybody was watching the news, I was a photojournalist for a couple of years, and I always like to stay topical on whatever news is going on. But when the coronavirus first came out, I really didn't pay attention to it. I actually thought people were blowing things out of proportion. They were overreacting. And when it started to hit Minot, I was at one of my father's favorite restaurants here in town, Schott's Crossroads. And I was getting him some gift certificates. And the coronavirus started hitting Minot earlier around that same time. And a week before, everything was normal. This place is constantly busy. The restaurant never shuts down. And I looked around on some of the waitresses that you normally are just scattered all over the place getting orders. And this place is constantly, they were just sitting around doing nothing. And I thought, well, this is weird because you don't see this happening. You don't see closures like this. About a week later, I went back to just to get some to-go meals for my dad. And I looked around and the place was like deserted. And it just hit me. It's like, boy, this kind of looks like a movie to me. So that following week, I began thinking, you know what? It would be interesting to see all these different businesses. How are they affected? Every business is going to be affected by it, but not every business's outcome is going to be the same.
Well, let's start with that, the coronavirus versus the Magic City. Of course, there's a Chamber of Commerce, Visit Minot, which is interested in getting people to do commerce in Minot. And you talked with Stephanie Shainrock. This is what she had to say.
I have to admit and say that North Dakota naive had kicked in a little bit. And then, of course, as time went, you started to quickly realize this is a factor. You know, when it hit, it did kind of feel like it hit quickly. There's no doubt that we, you know, when you look around and see all of the our community looking very different because we're a vibrant community. Minot is a vibrant, active community. And that has definitely changed.
So things have quieted down or did quiet down considerably in your town. And this was, as you mentioned, something very unlike previous experiences. So how did you choose the people you spoke to after Stephanie? Why did you pick, for example, Mark Free, the pastor of the Cornerstone Presbyterian Church?
Well, Mark Free, I had done a series of videos for him about a year prior, and he's a relative of mine. I chose Mark basically because he was available. One, I presented the idea to him, and he goes, man, I love it. Let's do it.
I kind of thought, you know, initially that we're in Minot, North Dakota. How's this really going to affect all of us? But when it came close to home and all of a sudden WHO, World Health Organization, said this is a pandemic and we have pastored in the midst of a crisis before. Many of you know the 2011 flood that happened in here was a crisis in our community. The number of people affected and the financial impact and the disruption in church services and all those things that went with it. So different crisis, but still a crisis.
They've adapted at the Cornerstone Presbyterian Church because they're online now. They have different ways of getting people involved in their religious experience.
Yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to talk with Mark about is how do you deal with people that go to church every Sunday and want to be close-knit with that family? He said that, you know, that the social distancing was a huge game changer for him because what do you do when nobody's allowed to go into a church service?
And they've also gotten very 21st century. They have this online presence. They've got a YouTube channel. They've got Facebook, and they've got people virtually visiting the church. Then you went to Rachel Cyan, who's the owner of Spectrum Fitness. And this is a new business. It's only 2.5 years old. So she's got a really unique problem. Describe it for our listeners.
I had initially met Rachel, her husband, her daughter, and it's a family-owned business. And it all started for me just about a year or so ago when I was doing my taxes, which is right across the street from her building. And I walked in there and I thought, I'd love to talk to you about doing a video, because I used to be in fitness when I was going to film school, and that's what I was doing in the Air Force. So I kind of knew what they did. And I just said, I'd love to talk to you about this. I've got a bunch of ideas. And we started with two commercials. And when I was thinking about this documentary, I thought, who am I going to interview? I thought, well, why don't we go back to the people that we've done videos for in the first place? And I called Rochelle up and I thought, this is the idea that I have, because I'd like to highlight somebody that works in health or fitness, whereas this pandemic is causing you to shut down. That must be huge for you.
I think we're all going to struggle in our own ways, but lucky for us, North Dakota is a wonderful state to live in during times of crisis. It's amazing how supportive North Dakota people are toward each other. Farmers, I mean, we're hardworking people, and I think that's going to be a gift for us, I think.
Rochelle is cautiously optimistic, obviously, putting on a brave face. And you talked with Dean Aberle. He's at a restaurant, and restaurants have been really hit hard. They're in the takeout business or pickup business now. They don't have people necessarily sitting there, although with this slow reopening that Governor Burgum is allowing, that's going to change. I noted that Dean also was very upbeat considering the circumstance he was facing.
A lot of the regulars, we, you know, they're coming in getting orders to go and just checking in. And it's always nice to see a smile or a happy face or a face that, you know, I can relate to or the staff can relate to. And it's just a warm feeling when that happens, when somebody, you know, comes in and gets something to go or calls and checks on you. And, you know, there's a lot of loyal people in the community, and it's heartwarming.
That's one of the things that struck me, because Homesteaders is another one of my dad's, and I think the local people of Minot, that's one of their go-to places, because it's local, you get a lot of great food for a great price. Dean was very optimistic. I was really surprised, because he didn't complain about, like, the government or complain about anything or the pandemic itself. And he was here during the 2011 flood. And so he kind of knew the lessons coming from that. But now with this, it's different, because nobody's really allowed to go in there and sit and eat. You have to go to takeout only. And he said he's struggling to find the hours, but he was very optimistic, very thankful. I mean, all of them were very, very upbeat, saying, we're going to get through this. The Minot community is very resilient.
I was intrigued with your discussion with Rob Fuller, because that was a business that actually saw an uptick because of the pandemic. He is the owner of Spartan Firearms. They sell guns, and they also have a shooting range that they're putting together there. He said this has been really big for his business.
It's been a skyrocket for our business, quite honestly. I mean, as this goes on, and I think the media sensationalizes it more and more, people get scared. We're worried about looting, we're worried about weird things going on, and so they want to be able to protect themselves and their family. What I noticed compared to other areas of the country, I think the bigger areas on the coast, the West Coast, the East Coast, they have this fear, and maybe it's because they're not as well educated to some things as we are around here. I don't see that fear and panic around here. I do see people obviously stocking up a little bit on ammunition, buying a new gun, this or that. We've seen people that have never been firearms owners all of a sudden want to own firearms. And so, I mean, it's, but I think it's different here than it is in the bigger cities.
Were you surprised by that, Paul, that he was doing so well?
In a way, yes, but in a way, no. And I say yes because I thought, well, are you guys being hit by this? And he said, well, yes and no, because they, Spartan Firearms bought the old Speedway restaurant that had been here for decades. They were moving into this big, huge facility, and they started it last year. And I said, well, how does this coronavirus affecting you? He goes, not really, because we're still going. He would have gotten worried if some of the workers that were constructing this had to leave. And none of them were, because they were doing everything safely. They were not doing anything that they were not supposed to do. And I thought, well, how does this thing affect hunting or those people who want to hunt with their kids and firearm safety and everything compared to, say, the panic or looting of a bigger city? And we talked about that. He says it was just great what he said, because he said that I think people around here are a little bit more common sense than just freaking out and panicking and going to buy any gun. it was just interesting to see how much his business is still going compared to some that I had to, you know, temporarily shut down.
Another business that you visited is run by Christine Staley. It's the Magic City Hoagies. Those sandwiches are popular with lots of folks. And I was intrigued by what she had to say about her employees, keeping them busy.
I had to make a quick decision. How could I allocate my employees to be here with what we needed to get done and accomplished? But also, how can I make sure everyone's making some money? And so I had to actually physically redo the schedule right away and then make sure that I can get all the information out to customers saying what we can do. Minot has the capability and the potential to really be a leader in North Dakota as a forefront city because we have those aspects where we have people from all over the world that come here. We also have a great university that brings unique attitudes and ideas. So I always say to people, it's not great now, but it's getting better all the time, and I have seen it.
What do you think about that response, Paul? The idea that there are some businesses that are hit harder than others. These are people. These are working people that have to be sustained.
I wasn't looking for anything specific, but one of the things that was repeated over and over again was just the resilience of the Minot community supporting each other. But they're still, I guess, going steady with their takeout orders and with their deliveries. And I said, well, that's good for you because you don't have to shut down.
Terry Aldrich was the final voice and face that we see in the documentary, which is Coronavirus Versus the Magic City. She, like the pastor at the Cornerstone Presbyterian Church, Mark Free, has learned some new skills here because she runs the Children's Music Academy, and she had to learn to use a program called Zoom.
We've been using that effectively now for a week, teaching classes utilizing the Zoom platform. So moms and dads and boys and girls are in their homes, and our teachers are in the studio teaching to them, providing the music education. I think North Dakotans, by and large, are a part of an independent and wonderfully resilient people.
And once again, Paul, she talks about the resilience of the people that she lives among.
I had worked for Terry 2 years ago with the Minot Area Council for the Arts. And I remembered her because she is so big in the community of the arts. And when I thought about a business, I thought, what about like Magic City Campus or Bishop Ryan High School? What are the schools? They have to be affected by this because nobody can go to school. And I just knew her and I thought, I want to talk with you because you have a children's music academy. What are you doing? And with Terry, it was just really nice to have her in there because it was really important for the kids to maintain their, I guess, level of whatever education that they're at. So it was really fun talking to her and seeing what she was doing.
Well, Paul Breno, you do it all. You're a producer, director, cinematographer, and editor of Coronavirus Versus the Magic City. So what do you get out of this? Who sees the documentary? How do you get it out there?
Well, that's a kind of a tough one because I was talking with the tourism board and I was letting them know that I was doing this, sort of just doing some, I should say, self-promotion. But this is what I did. Would you like to see it? Everything I do, I put up on YouTube. And I thought, you know what? I thought, why don't we send it out to film festivals and show the nation Minot and how good the people are here, you know, and how resilient they are going to, because hardworking people, farmers, military, oil, average everyday people. That's kind of what I got out of it. It's just I felt great about doing something for Minot.
You got some pretty good responses, I take it, from those festivals you sent it to.
Actually, it still shocks me still to this day that as a one-man band, I've been awarded either a semifinalist for Best Cinematography at the New York Cinematography Awards or other festivals that I'm still waiting to hear back from that I'm hoping, you know, does well. But to me, it's more like I'd like to show people Minot and show the good here. And I thought, this is really good. It just makes me feel great that people have such a good response to it.
Have you shown it in Minot yet?
Not yet. I wouldn't even know where to begin. Kind of mainly did it for me, just to have something to do during this time of nobody doing anything. And I thought, that's kind of what the good Lord gave me, is just the idea of doing it.
If you'd like to see Paul Breno's award-winning work, search that name on the internet. Breno is B-R-E-N-N-O. Paul Breno, thanks for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
Paul Breno is a filmmaker in Minot, and he has created the new documentary, Coronavirus Versus the Magic City. More Main Street in a moment.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Our Bill Thomas recently spoke with the editor of the North Dakota Quarterly, Bill Carraher. It's a literary magazine, and you'll hear about an offer for you to get a free copy. But first, Bill T. asked Bill C. to highlight one piece each of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry.
I love this story by Shane Castle, who's an Alaskan writer, and he writes about it. It's called Ursa. It's a piece of fiction, and he writes about a bear who's hibernating, but this bear, a mama bear, has her cell phone with her, and it sounds silly in premise, but the story itself is really kind of gripping, and I won't give too much away, but it's a type of story that I've gone back to even as editor, where you get a little tired of the content, you just want to see it out, right? I've gone back to two or three times just to read and digest more of a bear in the Alaskan wilderness coming out of hibernation, checking her cell phone messages. It's incredibly endearing. In terms of poetry, I'm going to cheat a little and give you two poems. We have two longer poems in this issue. One by James Bradley Wells. It's called When I Paint My Masterpiece. And the other is by Kimberly Becker, called Bringing Back the Fire. James Bradley Wells is a scholar translator, so his poem has a kind of palpable learnedness to it. I kind of enjoy. He's a translator of Pindar in particular. And Kimberly Becker's poem, Bringing Back the Fire, she's an indigenous writer. She's Cherokee. Her poem is just beautifully textured and engaging. And finally, I would be remiss if I didn't bring out one of the finest pieces, I think, in this issue is from a student who's just finished or soon finished at Concordia, and it's called Out of Silence Voice by a woman writer called Emily Meller. And I won't give anything of that away. It deserves attention and read. We don't publish very many first-time nonfiction writers, but her work, just when it was recommended to us, just kind of stuck in our brain, and we worked with her for a while to kind of polish it just right, our nonfiction editor did. And I think it's maybe the jewel in the entire volume. So there's some really, really good stuff.
Yes. I have only skimmed the issue, but I did look at that one because the title caught my eye, perhaps because it seems a little related to the present moment, as does another one that caught my eye, Death by Project Management Webinar.
Yeah, it's great. And we put it kind of at the end of the volume because I felt like it kind of, there was a sort of culminating aspect to it, this kind of, I don't know, it just felt like something you'd put at the end.
Well, I'm talking to Bill Carraher with the North Dakota Quarterly, and what's the special deal you're offering?
Right now, because so many people are cooped up in quarantine or cooped up in lockdown or whatever, staying home, we're giving away this issue for free as a PDF. It's a no-strings-attached PDF. If you go to our website, ndquarterly.org, you'll see right at the top, it'll say, go here if you want the issue, or available here for free or something. And you click on it. There's one more click you have to do. I don't even care if you're a bot. We don't ask you for email or anything like that. And you can download the PDF to your tablet or your laptop. We are also looking for subscribers, as always. Arts organizations at this time are struggling. Take care of your local bookstores and arts organizations and small publishers. And to make that a little bit more appealing, our publishing partner at the University of Nebraska is offering a 10% discount on subscriptions. And there's a coupon code that's good until the end of June. Yeah, you can download the PDF and read it. And if you say, wow, this is something great, I like what they're doing, go over to Nebraska and subscribe, and you'll get we're quarterly, but we publish two double issues a year. In paper, and they'll arrive in your mailbox just like always.
And I will say this issue is a weighty issue. I mean, I have it electronically, so it doesn't weigh anything, but it is, it's got a lot of material in it. And as we said, this is the North Dakota Quarterly, but it's not exclusively North Dakotan, but you do have some North Dakota authors in there.
Yeah, Emily Meller, who's from, well, I guess across the river, well, not sure. She's a Minnesotan, but she's from, you know, the Red River Valley over at Concordia, at least for now. And Bonnie Larson Steiger has a poem. She's the associate poet laureate. And this is actually the second issue that that she's appeared in. You know, we've also just continued some of these long traditions that have made North Dakota Quarterly a sort of famous literary magazine in certain circles. We all, like Kimberly Becker is an Indigenous author. We have quite a few Indigenous authors in this. And it's something that we continue, you know, whether they're coming from North Dakota's Native American communities, or they're coming from, you know, the Cherokee in North and South Carolina, or they're coming from abroad. We continue to try to capture Indigenous voices. That's a tradition of the Quarterly. The cover art is an amazing piece of cover art by Todd Hebert, who's a North Dakota artist. He's from Dickinson and is on the faculty here at the University of North Dakota. The editor's note is our nonfiction editor, who Sheila Liming, who's a UND faculty member, writing on bagpipes and Brexit. So we have, you know, not only are we drawing on our larger community, but we're, you know, drawing on people who are affiliated with the university or affiliated with the universities in the state and things like that. So,
well, and here's the thing. If you've wondered about the North Dakota Quarterly and just what it is and whether it's for you or not, you can go download a free copy right now and put it. You put it on your Kindle or Nook or iPad or whatever you got, or on read it on your computer. Check it out and see if you like it. No cost and easy way to find out about it. Bill, who do you think reads North Dakota Quarterly? What are you going for here?
We have a pretty diverse audience. One of the things that we're very proud of, probably hubristic a little bit, is we still the major research libraries, so the major kind of repositories of public culture in the U.S. continue to subscribe to the Quarterly. So one place we know it goes is not only to most of the libraries in the state of North Dakota, but also to major research libraries across the U.S. And in Europe and abroad as well. And what that means is that sometimes we don't know who reads them, because they go on to, you know, the current periodical shelf at the University of Michigan library, or at Stanford University's library, or at Heidelberg, and people will come and pick it up and read it there. As far as individual subscribers, we had a time 2-3 years ago where we shed a lot of our individual subscribers because we were struggling to keep afloat. And as we've begun to rebuild that base with our new publishing partner at the University of Nebraska, we found that we're attracting not only a lot of old friends. These are our kind of North Dakota readers who have been with us for 50 years, but also friends from all over the U.S. and abroad. We know that the Quarterly still lands on the shelf on the desks of publishers, of the captains of publishing in New York City and places like that. Compilers of, you know, America's best fiction and this kind of thing. But also it ends up, you know, in a lot of just people you wouldn't expect, you know, people living in Charlottesville, Virginia, or living in small towns in Georgia, or living in, you know, the mountains of Washington. I get emails from them saying, oh, you know, we get the Quarterly. We really enjoyed this issue. And so it's neat to see that kind of, you know, national, if not global, reach.
That's Bill Carraher, editor of the North Dakota Quarterly, rescued a couple of years ago from death by budget cut and produced at the University of North Dakota. For a free PDF copy or to subscribe to the print edition, go to northdakotaquarterly.org. Coming up on Main Street, a plan to help North Dakota's coal-fired power plants by storing CO2. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. It's being billed as the world's largest carbon capture facility. Project Tundra is designed to capture 90% of the carbon dioxide emissions from the Unit 2 generator at the Milton R. Young Power Station near Center. It's a joint project of UND's Energy and Environmental Research Center and Minn Kota Power Cooperative, the plant's owner. Stacy Dahl is Senior Manager of External Affairs for Minn Kota. She says the project has several elements. First, the capture facility needs to be developed,
which is essentially like a big chemical processing plant.
Then an underground storage facility has to be built, and Dahl says there's a business development side to it.
You need to attract the private investment to build this project.
Dahl says in talking to private investors, she finds there's a lot of interest in this carbon capture project. She says it needs state and federal support. The Federal Department of Energy has just issued a $17 million grant to the EERC for Project Tundra. As for uses of the CO2, Dahl says enhanced oil recovery is one of the potentials.
There is unlimited potential in North Dakota for this. But first things first, which is to build the capture facility, the storage complex, And from there, it's all the better to take this to the enhanced oil recovery step in the future.
And the 2020 road construction season is well underway across North Dakota. Department of Transportation construction engineer Phil Murdoff says the state is looking at spending close to $400 million on projects this year. Murdoff says so far cooperative weather has allowed things to get off to a good start. He says the COVID-19 pandemic has added a new wrinkle for contractors and their crews. Murdoff says policies and procedures have been put into place to help protect workers, though the type of work being done on a construction site may not always be easily done while trying to follow those practices. Murdoff says while workers are trying to practice safety measures to prevent the spread of the virus, he's encouraging drivers to keep safety in mind when traveling through the construction sites. He says that includes putting down your phone and obeying posted speed limits while in a construction zone. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support is provided by St. Gabriel's Community in Bismarck, providing assisted living, basic care, long-term skilled nursing services, short-term care and rehabilitation, and outpatient therapy. A member of the Benedictine Health System, stgabrielscommunity.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Charles Gorecki. He is the CEO of the Energy and Environmental Research Center at the University of North Dakota, and he joins us today to talk about Project Tundra. Charles, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Doug. Great to be here.
A little bit of background, first of all, for our listeners who may not know about the mission of the Energy Environmental Research Center. Lay it out for us.
Yeah, so the EERC, or Energy and Environmental Research Center, is part of the University of North Dakota. We're a non-teaching branch, and our vision is to lead the world in developing solutions to energy and environmental challenges.
And this is an important time for that, I take it.
Absolutely. We have about 200 employees at the EERC, 220 if you count temporaries and students. We have a lot of great partners in the state and around the country and world that are certainly experiencing some challenges at the moment.
Well, let's talk about the challenge of Project Tundra. What is it? I know that you're working with Minn Kota Power on this. Why is it important?
Project Tundra, as you've already pointed out, is a project that's led and managed by Minn Kota Power. And the EERC is really grateful to be part of the team that's supporting Project Tundra. So what Project Tundra is Minn Kota's vision to see the potential for CO2 capture on their Milton R. Young Power facility near Center, North Dakota, and then capturing that carbon dioxide, compressing it, and storing it in the subsurface for dedicated storage, or sending it to oil fields for enhanced oil recovery.
On April 24th, there was an announcement by the U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Fossil Energy that they're going to be distributing about $131 million for carbon capture and utilization and storage project. Of that, $17 million plus goes to this particular project. How does it work?
Yeah, so in this particular case, we have been working with Minn Kota for a number of years now on a program that the Department of Energy started called Carbon Safe. We were selected about 3 years ago for a phase two effort, which looked at the potential for capturing and storing carbon dioxide in the subsurface near the Milton R. Young Power Facility and also Basin Electric's Antelope Valley Power Facilities. In Carbon Safe Phase 2, we actually drilled what we would call a characterization well near each of those power facilities to look at the geology and see if it was suitable to inject and store CO2. In these formations are filled currently with salt water. They don't have any potential use now or in the future. And so that was very successful. We put in a proposal for a phase three, really focused around the Milton R. Young Power Facility. And we were selected, as you just pointed out, $17 million from the Department of Energy, and then accompanying cost share from Minn Kota, Schlumberger, and Computer Modeling Group. And what we'll be doing in this part of the project is drilling a well that would potentially become a monitoring well or an injection well as part of the CO2 storage aspect. And including working towards getting a permit from the North Dakota Industrial Commission, who has primacy over the injection of carbon dioxide in the state.
So there are a number of processes here. One is separating the CO2 from the exhaust plume of the plant. Then you've got to inject it into the ground. I assume that takes some sort of power supply, some pumps or something. And then you've got to have a safe place underground, and from the looks of it, it's about a mile or so underground, to sequester it, to store it.
That's correct, yeah. And so this project is really focused on just the storage aspect. We also have several other projects, and Minn Kota has several projects looking at the other parts of the CCUS, or the carbon capture. So Minn Kota actually was the recipient of a FEED study, so front-end engineering design project, looking at the design and engineering of a capture facility at the plant. So they were also, that's a separate award that Minn Kota was selected for, looking at the capture side. As you've also mentioned, after you captured it, then you would compress it to a dense phase so that it's easy to transport and inject. And then it's the storage aspect, which we're looking at with CarbonSafe.
So what will the $17 million grant that was awarded on the 24th of April allow you to do?
It'll allow us to drill one of those wells that I mentioned, which would either become an injection well in the future or a monitoring well. We'll be able to collect the data to ensure that the geology is suitable, which we already expect it to be, but it'll give us that confirmation. That data will be used to construct the permits that Minn Kota would submit. That would the state of North Dakota has primacy over. That would give us the project team that is the ability to inject and store carbon dioxide in the future.
How do you determine a safe place to sequester CO2?
There's a number of different criteria that we look for in a site when we're trying to determine if it's suitable for geologic storage. We first want to make sure it's, in general, we want a site to be about 3,000 feet or deeper in the subsurface. At that depth, you have pressure and temperature, which allows the CO2 to be in dense phase, so it takes up less room in the subsurface. Then we would look at a formation that was permeable or has the ability to easily be injected into. We have found a number of those formations that are deeper than 3,000 feet, as you mentioned, about over 5,000 feet near the Minn Kota plant. Then you would also look at, for suitable seals. So these would be like shales. So what we're looking for as far as an injection target would be maybe a sandstone, something that is currently filled with salt water, and we would inject carbon dioxide into that. And we would look for impermeable seals, and these are usually shales or salts. In this case, we have shales and some salts mixed in with the above the target formation, which is the Broom Creek, or that's the primary target.
Now, this is a test of the technology. How much room or how much space or how much sequester capability would you need to have for a plant like the Milton R. Young plant?
Milton R. Young, if they were to capture all of their CO2 from the Unit 2, would be close to 4 million tons of carbon dioxide per year. So you would need, if over a maybe let's say a 20-year time period or a 25-year time period, you need enough space for 100 million tons of carbon dioxide, which we have done a lot of assessments over the past two decades. Initially, we did assessments on the geology of the North Dakota and surrounding region for its potential for storage. We later, through a number of different projects, did pilot tests. Then we did full demonstration tests. We worked on technology development for monitoring and reducing risk characterization technologies. And so we've come a long ways in understanding the suitability and as far as a geologically superior place to store carbon dioxide, the Williston Basin, which is what we have here in North Dakota, is an excellent target for storing whether it be CO2 or produced water or anything like that. It's already proven that it can successfully trap and capture millions of barrels of oil, and it has done that for millions of years.
So would you have to an ongoing search for suitable sites, or is the site that you have found near the Milton R. Young plant suitable for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, Milton R. Young site would be suitable. Part of the CarbonSafe effort was, this was originally a research effort from the Department of Energy. We needed to find suitable targets that their call was at least 50 million tons of storage. which is what we started looking at. But when we started working closer with Minn Kota, recognized that it would maybe be 100 million tons if they were to capture everything from Unit 2. And there is certainly plenty of space in the subsurface. The Broom Creek Formation itself has billions of tons of storage potential.
Charles Gorecki is the CEO of the EERC, the Energy and Environmental Research Center at UND. We're talking about Project Tundra, which would sequester carbon dioxide from the Milton R. Young Generating Plant in North Dakota, a very large plant. Charles, you mentioned that the carbon dioxide, when it's at that depth and under pressure and heat, changes a bit. Is it ever extractable, or would it ever blow out, or how does it change?
As we go deeper into the subsurface, just like you would, for example, scuba diving, as you go deeper underwater, you experience more pressure. The same thing is true if you go deeper into the earth, you have experienced more pressure. So that pressure actually compresses the gas. Carbon dioxide at surface conditions is a gas form. But if we apply pressure to it, it actually goes through a liquid form and then what we call a dense phase, where it has properties similar to a gas, but density similar to that of a liquid. So it takes up less space in the subsurface. It almost has the density of water, very similar to that of oil and gas, which is part of the reason it makes such a good fluid for enhanced oil recovery, is it has a similar density to the oil that you're trying to extract. And it also mixes more readily with oil. One of the reasons that we can do this effectively is we look for those suitable seals. So it is a little less dense than the formation fluid, so it tends to rise vertically. But that's where we look for suitable seals, so those shales that would prevent it from moving vertically. And we also do a thorough assessment of any type of penetrations through the seal. These would be existing well bores, for example. There doesn't happen to be very many well bores in the region around Milton R. Young's power facility, but any that have been there, we have assessed and determined that they are safe, and we will be monitoring them should the project go forward to injection.
Now, once this takes place, and you've sequestered the carbon about a mile underneath the North Dakota prairie, does it have to be monitored? And if so, how long does it have to be monitored?
Yes, it needs to be monitored through the duration of the injection period, and then it needs to have some post-closure monitoring. The minimum would be by state primacy would be about 10 years, and it could be longer than that depending upon how the CO2 is behaving. If you see that if your monitoring techniques indicate that it is not migrating, not moving laterally in any direction, the pressures in the subsurface are stable, then that would indicate that it is basically stable in place and not moving. And so you may be able to cease monitoring after the prescribed period from the state of North Dakota.
Let's talk about the value of this research and the application of it to the coal generating industry in North Dakota. There's been a lot of concern around the world, of course, about environmental and air pollution and the global warming kind of effect that everybody's focused on, or most people are these days. What value can you put on this particular technology to ease the concern people have about what comes out of the smokestacks?
Yeah, with this type of a project, we can produce power that is reliable 24/7, regardless of the temperature outside and whether the wind is blowing, and at the same time have zero carbon emitted to the atmosphere, or maybe they're just a very small amount of carbon emitted to the atmosphere, much less than a gas-fired turbine, for example. We have hundreds of years of lignite right there at the surface. We're not having to transport that anywhere, just mine it at the plant, produce reliable power, and then have zero carbon or very low carbon emissions. So it provides that reliable power at the same time as providing a power that has no carbon or very low carbon.
Well, this test of the project that you're proposing at the Milton R. Young plant is made possible by over $17 million. What is the cost benefit here in terms of how much would it cost to do this, for example, at Coal Creek or some other power plant in the state? And how does that affect the price of electricity?
It's a great question. The CO2 capture and storage projects are very costly endeavors. A capture facility could be $1 billion on a coal-fired power plant. The way that these are being financed is the federal government passed a set of tax credits known as 45Q tax credits, which says that for every ton of carbon dioxide that is captured and stored in the subsurface, the capturer can get $50 per ton tax credit. So you could do some quick math on that. If you're storing 4 million tons per year in the subsurface, you can capture that tax credit for 12 years as the law is written now. You could potentially pay for $1 billion capture facility. That's kind of the rough numbers. The challenge of it is that our power utilities are not for profit. They don't have no way to utilize a carbon credit. They need to seek partners who do have a tax appetite that can invest in the capture facility. At the end of the day, the effect on for the consumer that buys the power is you don't have an increase in your power cost because of this tax credit.
Given the competitive price of natural gas these days, and of course these things can change, will this added cost in the short term disadvantage coal?
That's a great question. I don't know if I'm the best suited to answer that. Certainly the low price of natural gas is a challenge for coal to compete in the marketplace, but that can change very quickly. We saw in the polar vortex, for example, challenges where the wind wasn't blowing or it was too cold at that time for the wind turbines to go. At the same time, we had a lot of demand for natural gas for home use, and we were challenged to be able to supply enough gas for power production at that same time in certain areas. So, you know, it may be competitive in price on natural gas, but you do have that great reliability when it comes to mine mouth coal-fired power plants.
We're talking about Project Tundra, which is aimed at aiding coal-fired power plants in the state of North Dakota and sequestering that CO2. There are other projects, other bits of research that are going on, I assume at the EERC and for that matter elsewhere around the world, which would use that CO2, perhaps in oil and gas extraction.
Absolutely. That remains one of the great areas of research that we're doing at the EERC. We have been recently producing as much as 1.5 million barrels of oil per day in North Dakota. That's probably shrinking at least some right now with our present price environment and the demand reduction that we've seen as a result of COVID-19. But certainly enhanced oil recovery is a great technology in which you could capture carbon dioxide from a point source like a power plant, utilize it for enhanced oil recovery, utilizing the wells that you've already drilled, the oil you've already found. And at the end of the day, you could produce power and oil that have a lower carbon footprint or carbon intensity than power without carbon capture and oil that's not being produced from enhanced oil recovery. So there's a definite win-win there if you can link those both up.
What about using this Project Tundra sequestration process for other energy-intensive industries? Maybe they're not making electricity, but they're making steel or something like that.
Absolutely. Carbon capture utilization and storage is one of the only technologies for some industries, such as you mentioned, steel, cement, other industrial processes. There may not be a switch that you can do where you eliminate the carbon emissions. So carbon capture, utilization, and storage is the option or the best option aside from not creating those products to reduce that carbon intensity. There's a project in Norway called Northern Lights. The process there is they're going to be looking at capturing carbon dioxide from a number of different industrial facilities, collecting all those together and storing them offshore North Sea, which they currently have a couple of projects there now.
Well, let's talk about the issue of the moment, and that's the pandemic. Has that hampered any of your research processes at the EERC?
Well, it certainly has affected the EERC. I'm calling you from my house right now.
Yes.
Most of the
I'm talking to you from my basement.
Yeah, me as well. So most of the EERC staff is working from home. We do have A few people working at the EERC now on some of our in our pilot facilities and our laboratories. So it certainly has affected us, certainly has affected some of our partners. They're experiencing these same types of challenges. But we are 100% open for business and working. I think that we were ideally set up for working in a virtual manner. We've been doing it for a long time, not at this level, but we've been doing it a long time. And so we're open for business and helping our partners as much as we possibly can. The research projects continue to come in. The Department of Energy and others are still putting out funding announcements, and we're competing into those. So we have our challenges, but we are also, I think, handling them as best we can.
Remind us again of the timeline here for this test of the technology at the Milton R. Young plant. When would the sequestration begin, and when would it be declared, suitable or unsuitable?
That's up to Minn Kota to decide. They need to go through, as I mentioned, the FEED study first on the capture. Simultaneously, we're working on the subsurface side. So we're making sure that the subsurface is suitable, working towards that permit. They're working towards that same type of a timeline on the FEED study. Should all that come out to look positive for Minn Kota, they would make a decision in the next couple of years.
Well, when you look down the road, if this is successful, do you see drilling rigs outside of most of these coal-fired power plants in the state?
It's certainly possible. I think we need to see a few successes in how these projects get financed. We need to see effective permitting, which I think we were going to see from the state of North Dakota in our industrial commission. So I think it's entirely possible. We've also been working with our partners at Red Trail Energy. They've been working towards a class 6 CO2 injection permit there as well, outside of their ethanol facility. So capturing carbon dioxide from their ethanol fermentation process and compressing that and storing it in the subsurface as well. So we're really starting to see that commercial deployment of the technology, which is really, for me, gratifying since I've been working on carbon capture, utilization, and storage since I started at the EERC in 2007.
How big a game changer is this? I mean, the United States, of course, has a lot of coal-fired power plants, but China builds them by the dozens. How might this change the world's output of CO2?
As far as volumes, I couldn't tell you exact volumes, but this is one of the places where the United States really needs to show leadership, and I believe we are. By developing those technologies in the United States, we're able to then transfer them to places like China or Africa, where we expect to see power demand and growth continue for a long time. And if your resource is coal, for example, and you're a developing country, and you've got many of your populace living in energy poverty, it gives us the opportunity to develop those technologies so they can utilize their resources to produce reliable power and then help bring their populace out of poverty. So I'm really excited about it. I think it's a game changer for the globe from a reduction of carbon emissions and also to allow for us to bring people into a higher standard of living and at the same time benefit the environment.
Well, I thank you for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you.
Charles Gorecki is CEO of the EERC, the Energy and Environmental Research Center at UND. Dakota Datebook is next.
Many federal government employees are working from home, including thousands of Social Security Administration workers.
Telework is proving a great boon to the service Social Security provides to the American people.
The data shows productivity is on the up.
They start getting stuff done and they just keep on going.
Could telework become the new norm? That's on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Daybook for May 4th. A long time ago, countless multitudes of passenger pigeons migrated through the Red River Valley in springtime in search of food. The trees along the Red River were roosting places, full of commotion and loud noises, the wing feathers clattering before landing on tree branches, pigeons calling out, "Kee, kee, kee, kee," and "Coo, coo, coo." Thousands of flapping wings sounded like a roar of distant thunder. Much larger than mourning doves, male passenger pigeons were more colorful, with light blue coloring on their heads, with neck and sides a blend of gold, emerald green, and rich crimson. The birds had beautiful, sparkling red eyes. Passenger pigeons were called blue meteors for their grayish-blue bodies and fantastic flying speeds, 60 miles per hour. To fly so fast, passenger pigeons had massive breast muscles to create great power of flight in long migrations. These muscles were their strength and their weakness, for the flesh, of a dark color, was much sought after as tasty food. On this date in 1804, fur trader Alexander Henry the Younger at Pembina wrote in his journal, "Extraordinary number of wild pigeons. I never before saw so many." Indeed, in 1800, Alexander Henry had previously noted, "Pigeons were in great numbers. The trees were every moment covered with them." In later decades, Donald Murray said, "I remember when I used to see flocks of pigeons following the course of the Red River, which were so large that the front of each flock was out of sight in the north, whilst the tail was out of sight in the south." Likewise, in 1873, military man Elliot Kuss wrote of, "Countless flocks of wild pigeons pervaded the atmosphere of the Red River Valley. We observed them continually during our voyage down the river, and at Pembina, streaming through the air in endless succession of flocks." Alas, market hunters relentlessly killed so many passenger pigeons that flocks were devastated by the 1880s, and these wild pigeons ended totally extinct soon thereafter. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hello, teachers. I'm Tim Wollenzine, Education Services Manager at Prairie Public, inviting you to our weekly web chat series. This free professional development video series features area educators sharing resources, ideas, tips, and tricks to help you maximize your teaching power. No need to travel for inspiration. Get convenient, flexible PD from your home or classroom. Continuing education credit is available. Learn more at prairiepublic.org.
Tuesday on Main Street, Green Thumbs Up. Horticulturist Ron Smith and our Ashley Thornburg will talk about starting the spring planting season. And Robert Wilkie, U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs, will join us for a discussion on how the pandemic is affecting veterans and how his department has been coping with the challenge. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.